This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 51 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me as he always is Mike Morrison. Today we'll be discussing the Deep Space Nine character, Dr. Mora, and the ethics of scientific research. Mike, you were telling me before the show that you had a special request for this topic in particular.
I did. I received a note from our good friend over at Melodic Treks, Brandon Shea Mutala, B-Shea as we call him, who threw a topic at me that at first I kind of pushed it away because, Zachary, we've talked about ethics, medical ethics before here on Metatrex, but specifically he had suggested that we talk about Dr. Mora and his relationship with Odo and the ethics involved in experimentation. And I thought it was kind of interesting, but again, I sort of pushed it aside. But you and I were talking about possible topics and brought it up, and it had piqued both of our interest and thought we could go a little different angle than we had before when talking about medical ethics. And I'm always game to talk Deep Space Nine. I've got my hair slicked back and my Bajoran earring in, so we're ready to get down to business.
I think what's interesting, Mike, about Dr. Mora and his relationship with Odo is that Odo undergoes some significant changes from the time that he's first discovered and starts interacting with Dr. Mora to the character Odo that we see in Deep Space Nine. When Odo's first discovered, he's basically a gelatinous, what people think of as a non-life form. There's no indication that he's actually a life form, much less a sentient life form. And then as Odo develops, he moves from that phase into being basically what could be seen as a shape-shifting, non-sentient life form. It becomes clear that he's a life form, has some shape-shifting mimetic ability, but not necessarily a sentient life form. And then eventually, Dr. Mora discovers that Odo is a sentient being and helps, you know, through various poking and prodding methods, helps Odo, hone his shape-shifting abilities and helps develop his personality, leading to the Odo that we see as a fully developed autonomous being. You can think of it maybe as the four stages of Odo and as he works with Dr. Mora. But I guess what's interesting about that, as opposed to, other kinds of discussions we might have about medical research or medical ethics, generally your test subject in medical ethics doesn't really change, right? A rat is a rat is a rat, or a frog is a frog is a frog. It doesn't change states in the dramatic sense that Odo changes states from the time he's first discovered to the character we see in Deep Space Nine. And I guess the reason I find that interesting is that our moral and ethical obligations to a test subject might change depending on what type of being it is. You know, if Odo had been a purely non-sentient, non-life form, gelatinous substance, merely just a piece of stuff, you know, a sort of gelatinous goo inside of a bucket, and that's all Odo was, and it wasn't sentient, it wasn't even a life form, you wouldn't think you would have any ethical obligation to that being. Like, I don't think I have an ethical obligation to a warp core or to a nacelle, right? These are just inanimate objects, or to a phaser. These are just inanimate objects, so you don't have any moral and ethical obligation to them as a being. And, as it becomes clear that Odo is a life form and then a sentient life form, then an autonomous sentient life form, I think there's various degrees or various types of moral and ethical obligation that emerge out of those changes of state. So I think this is something that Odo and Dr. Mora basically discuss when they interact. You know, Dr. Mora's perception and his take on things is basically that he's helped Odo reach his full potential, that all of these methods are justified because Odo has become the being that he is, and they were necessary to help Odo reach his potential. And Odo looks back and says, but wait, look, you know, look at the ways you poked and prodded me, and you know, I was sitting here suffering or in pain or, you know, not having a pleasant experience. And Dr. Moore would just say, look, I didn't even know you were a life form yet. So don't hold me accountable for treating you like that, you know, as if you were the Odo that you are now, back when you were just a pile of goo in a bucket.
Zachary, what I find interesting about this is at the heart of this discussion is the idea of informed consent. In medical ethics, it is required that before you begin any type of procedure or any type of experiment that involves the patient, you have to receive consent from them. And it has to be consent in which you lay out all of the specifics, including the risks and the details of what you're going to be doing, the purpose for which you're going to be doing it. And then once the patient is informed, they then give you informed consent. Now, when you're dealing with a gelatinous non-life form, as Dr. Moore first thought Odo was, he's not going to get consent from that life form, from that non-life form, from this gelatinous. I mean, at first, Odo appears to them as a really interesting goo. But once he determined that this was actually a life form, from that moment, the stakes changed. Everything changed. And I think probably where, and I'm just going to jump right in, I think probably where Dr. Moore probably crossed some ethical boundaries, he had an obligation to get consent once he determined that it was life form. Now, interestingly enough, when I took ethics, specifically dealing with medical ethics, the example that was laid out, and it's I pulled out some of my old papers in preparation for the podcast, and interestingly enough, in the classroom, the example that was given was that of a Martian, believe it or not. If if a research scientist were to want to experiment using a Martian.
You mean a Ferengi in Area 51.
A Ferengi from Area 51. Yes, but language barrier is going to be a problem. It's going to be a hindrance. Obviously, the research scientist doesn't speak Martian, and the Martian probably doesn't speak English or whatever language the research scientist is using. So, in an instant like that, what is required is to just push the experimentation aside, forget about it until the language barrier can be bridged in order to get informed consent.
Well, Mike, as you've described it, I don't think that the move from gelatinous non-life form to a non-sentient life form is the key move. Frankly, because a non-sentient life form just can't give consent to anything, right? We do experiments here in the real world on lab rats and whatnot. And we don't expect lab rats to sign a consent form unless it's Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of NIMH or something like that, right? But the more important move that you're describing from a being that can't give consent to a being that can give consent is not just a life form, but a sentient life form, a self-aware, autonomous life form with some free will. We don't generally think it's ethical to do experiments on people against their will or out of ignorance if they don't know they're being experimented on, like secret government experiments, that kind of thing. We don't generally think that is moral and ethical. But we do perform here in the real world all kinds of experiments on non-sentient or lower life forms, beings that can't give consent. And there's plenty of cases, it's not even that simple even for humans, that there are plenty of cases where you have proxy consent, where a parent will allow their child to have some sort of experimental research done on them when the child is assumed not to be able to give consent because they haven't reached an age of consent, adulthood. And the parents give proxy consent, or a guardian in some situation gives proxy consent for a certain type of experimental procedure. So it's not even that simple for humans, much less lower life forms. So, but the crucial feature there seems to be that in order for a valid experiment to take place on higher life forms or sentient life forms, there has to be some sort of consent by someone, whether direct consent or proxy consent. And I think that there's basically this Kantian principle there that we treat other beings with respect for their autonomy and for their own free will, that we don't violate their own free will and we don't use them as a means to our own ends without including them in the decision. And so there's just this basic Kantian deontological ethics principle there that, you know, when we're dealing with higher life forms, at least we treat them as beings equal to ourselves with their own sense of free will that we don't try to violate. But for lower life forms, I think it's a lot more complicated. And for Odo, when he's first discovered, there's no evidence that he's sentient yet. So I think it's plausible that Dr. Mora treats Odo justifiably as a lower life form or even as a non-life form, like we've described him as a puddle of interesting goo. Mm-hmm. But the second Odo becomes conscious, then the game changes, right? Then it's a question of how is Dr. Mora aware of his consciousness? Has he made an effort to get Odo's consent in some way or another? But I guess it's even more complicated than that, because as an adult, I'm trying to think, I come from an education background, and in education, oftentimes you're dealing with adult students, sure. People who are adults going back to school, doing whatever. Oftentimes people don't know what's in their own best interest. You need someone who's gone through a path before to lay the path for you and say, you need to walk down this path because your life will be better if you do. You may not want to. It's going to be difficult. It might be a little painful, but here's what you need to do in order to get to the next level. And so even if Odo doesn't consent to being poked and prodded and electrified and the various things that Dr. Mora does to him, Dr. Mora can plausibly say, look, I know what it's like to be a functioning, sentient, autonomous being here in the real world who can take on projects and have goals and work for things and have relationships. And Odo, even though you're sentient, you can't do any of those things yet. So even though this is a little painful, this is important because you can do all these other things. And I see the value that you don't see yet because you don't have that experience. So it's an interesting question whether even if Odo doesn't consent to being poked and prodded, even once Dr. Mora realizes that he's sentient, is Dr. Mora justified in saying this is for your greater good, even though you yourself don't realize it?
I think there are a couple of important considerations there. I think that Dr. Mora had an obligation once he determined that this puddle of interesting goo was a life form. I think he had an obligation at that point to, rather than continue with the experimentation, that the path, the trajectory that he was on, I think his obligation at that point was to stop and then determine whether or not this is a sentient life form. You mentioned experimentation on lab rats and things of this sort. I mean, at one time we were performing experiments on other life forms that we consider to be lower life forms. It's now very, very controversial.
Or even humans that we didn't recognize as fully human.
Absolutely. And so I think there are still some ethical considerations that need to be made in determining whether this was just, a lower life form. And, I think about the difference between, say, a plant and an animal. I think there's an obligation there to make that determination. So I'm going to stick with my step between determining that this was a non-life form and a life form as being an important step, because I think once you determine that you have a life form, your next ethical consideration has got to be whether or not this is a sentient life form.
Well, I think which step is the more important step is an interesting question. Is the most important ethical step the step from non-life form to a life form, whether it's sentient or not, or is the more important step the step from a lower life form that may not be sentient to a higher level life form that has some sense of autonomy or free will or self-awareness or sentience?
I think by any measure, that's the most important step, but I don't want to not consider the step from non-life form to non-sentient life form.
Well, I think it matters which ethical perspective you're taking. If you're taking a consequentialist perspective or a utilitarian perspective in which the goal is to maximize pleasure and benefit and minimize pain and suffering, then the important ethical feature of the being in question is whether that being can suffer. Can that being experience enjoyment or experience pain and suffering? And even if a being is not necessarily sentient in a strong sense or self-aware in an autonomous sense, a being like a lab rat or Odo is a pile of goo, even if he were a non-sentient pile of goo, but still a life form, maybe he could experience pain and suffering without being self-aware in a strong sense. So if that were the case, then the important move is, can this being suffer or not? Who cares if it's self-aware? Who cares if it has an identity or sentience per se? But if that being can suffer, then it's entitled to moral and ethical consideration. Same thing with lab rats, same thing with frogs, same things with humans, of course. If you know, we can obviously experience pain and suffering, but and I think nowadays we tend to accept that lower life forms do as well, but that wasn't always assumed to be true. Sure. In the history of philosophy. And certainly in Star Trek, you know, we they're very charitable with how they treat almost any life form inside Star Trek. There's very much a reverence for different types of life forms. So that's one approach, the consequentialist perspective, in which what matters is the being's ability to feel pain or suffering. The other approach is more of a Kantian approach, in which the relevant ethical feature of the being in question is not its ability to experience pain or suffering, but its autonomy, its sense of self-determination, its own free will. And you know, that's where, you know, the thing you're describing, this idea of consent, that's a Kantian idea. Sure. That we don't experiment against on beings that haven't consented, because to do so would violate their free will. And so lower life forms that don't have the ability to consent, it's an interesting question whether from a Kantian standpoint or a deontological standpoint, whether those beings are entitled to moral and ethical consideration at all, insofar as they don't have a free will, they don't have a sense of self-awareness. So there's no issue of violating their autonomy or not treating them with this sort of higher level Kantian rationalistic respect, because they don't have any of those features. And so I think on that perspective, it's almost too easy to say, look, those beings just aren't entitled to consideration at all. They haven't become agents yet. They don't have free will. They don't have an identity. So how can they be entitled to that kind of consensual moral consideration, right? It's just they don't have the relevant features, so they're just not entitled to that kind of consideration. I think that's overly quick, and I think if you do a deeper dive into either one of these ethical theories, the consequentialist standpoint or the Kantian or deontological standpoint, you'll realize, I think, that the situation is not as simple as I've made it out to be. I've kind of given the philosophy 101 vastly oversimplified view of these two ethical theories. With the consequentialist standpoint, insofar as the goal is to try to maximize overall good consequences and minimize overall bad consequences, then you're into kind of a numbers game. Are you justified in harming one being for the sake of achieving a greater good, either for that being itself or for a greater number of beings at large, whether it's the citizens of the Federation or the Bajoran people at large, in the case of Odo? You know, in that case, you can plausibly say, look, you're justified, because if the goal is to maximize overall good, then if you cause a little bit of harm here and cause a greater amount of good somewhere else, mm-hmm. then you're justified in doing that kind of research. And then I think you're into a lot of really practical, granular questions like, you know, how do you weigh the suffering of a test subject versus the overall benefit? Is it a matter of quantity? Is it a matter of degree? Is it a matter of type? Do some types of pain and suffering matter more than others? Do some types of benefits matter more than others? Do some lives matter more than others? Do we give more weight to the benefits to a sentient being than to the pain we would cause a non-sentient being? How do we make these relative comparisons of benefits and pains? And so the consequentialist perspective is actually really complicated. You know, it's not just a question of let's harm one person and benefit 100. You can get down in the weeds and pick that apart and realize it's not even that complicated, not even that simple for a case like Odo. Mm-hmm. And from the deontological perspective, it's also not as simple, mainly because Kantian philosophy is only one variety of deontological ethics. You can plausibly ask the question, look, when you're experimenting on a test subject, whether sentient or not, of course, Kantian ethics emphasizes the sentience or the rationalistic or self-determination aspect of a being. But if you set that aside and say, you know, in general, deontological ethics is about rules, you know, rule-based ethics. That includes things like theology. It includes mm-hmm. any sort of list of rights and wrongs, do this, don't do that. And there's a host of different types of those theories. And Kantian ethics is the main one, but it's also not the only one. I think you can plausibly say, look, does experimenting on any sort of test subject, even if it's a non-sentient one, setting Kantian philosophy aside, have we violated any moral rules? And in the case of the Federation, you might say, look, if you pick up some random life form out in space somewhere and take it into your sick bay and start doing experiments, you might very well be violating some sort of scientific code of ethics, or you might be violating the Prime Directive or any host of regulations, which are rules that Starfleet has laid out. So if you think of ethics from a rule-based standpoint, it's important to ask, well, are you just violating any outright strict rules about what you do and don't do, right or wrong? Some of these rules might be just conventions that are agreed upon either by the Federation or by the Bajoran people. Some of them might be deeper moral convictions, you know, rule-based ethics, like you don't murder and you do help, you know, old ladies who've fallen on the sidewalk, you know, these rights and wrongs, things we do and don't do to have a healthy society. In this case, you can ask, well, have you violated a rule if you just pick up a random life form and start experimenting on it? And I think plausibly you can say, yeah, you violated something. It's hard to specify why you've broken a rule there, though. I mean, if it's just, unless it's a statute. I mean, certainly there are statutes that the Federations or the Bajorans have about what you do and you don't do. But we're talking about sort of moral principles. What would be just a moral rule that you would violate? So that's one way of looking at this from a deontological standpoint. But like I said before, there's a host of different kinds of deontological ethical theories. I mean, for example, most theological ethical standpoints are rule-based. You know, anytime you have a higher being, a god or a prophet giving a set of commands, you're basically talking about a list of rules, do this and don't do that. And I think for the Bajorans, who are a spiritual people that have, you know, ethical principles that derive from their experience with the prophets and their religious leaders, I think you could plausibly say about the Bajorans, look, you know, they have some sort of responsibility to nature at large, to lower life forms included. This idea of stewardship over lower life forms is kind of a rule-based ethics. You know, when, you know, you don't go out and you harm lower life forms for fun and profit. You just don't do that. You take care of them. You don't harm them. And that's part of taking care of the world around you or the universe around you. Being a higher level life form, you have some sort of responsibility to lower level life forms and to nature as a whole. And so I think of that as a kind of rule-based ethics. This is something you don't do, that you're violating your own requirements to be a steward of lower level life forms. And so even if it's not, if you're not talking about a conscious life form, you can still find some sort of entry into the discussion from a deontological standpoint, whether it's, you know, scientific and medical ethics or cultural standards and norms, these rule-based ideas, or it could be, you know, rules about what you do and don't do or what your responsibilities are from a theological standpoint. And I think normally we wouldn't invoke that in a discussion about Star Trek and philosophy. But in this case, Dr. Mora happens to be Bajoran, right? So he has a roughly Bajoran spiritual sense. And I think with that comes some sort of ethical responsibility that's handed down from the prophets or from the Vedics or from the or from someone.
And I get the feeling generally from the Bajoran people that they have an overall respect for life. And it's very, very speculative, I think, of us to really take that in one direction or another. But I think kind of bringing it out of universe into our own world here with religious considerations, you mentioned, you know, this sense of stewardship over lower life forms. And I think that typically tends to be the majority opinion among people who are of faith. There is a sense of stewardship over lower life forms. But that's not always been the case, Zachary. There are really kind of two extremes on this. There's the one extreme where, and I would probably classify, even my daughter would be someone I would classify in this category. I mean, she wouldn't hurt a fly because she recognizes, you know, the overall circle that, I hate to, you know, wax all Mufasa here, but, you know, she recognizes the overall circle of life and, you know, how one life form affects another life form. So she literally wouldn't hurt a fly, and she can't watch those ASPCA commercials because she just goes into hysterics over that. And I don't let her watch certain shows on Animal Planet because where she sees animals being abused, she gets angry, and she's of that extreme. But there's another extreme where this idea, at least from a biblical sense, that God gave man dominion over lower life forms, over the earth and over lower life forms. And so, you know, beat your chest, you have dominion over these things, and we're gonna kill them, we're gonna use them, we're gonna do whatever we want to with them because we have dominion over them. But I don't get that sense from the Bajoran people. I get more of a sense they have an overall respect for life. But
wait. So you're saying Dr. Mora, he has an overall stewardship of the world around him, but he still wants to find a way to eat Odo? Maybe you can make a pancake out of him?
Certainly gelatinous. Maybe, I don't know, maybe a jello mold?
A shape-shifting pancake?
A shape-shifting pancake, jello mold. Jello mold. I, you know, like my aunt used to make with the fruit in it. I bet he probably threw some fruit in there. And
I can picture him kind of stirring in a little sour cream, dropping some cherries in.
It's Dr. Mora's jello mold. You know, and I think this would probably, honestly, this would be a good segue to muddy the water a little bit, because we're not just dealing here, Zachary, with Bajoran ethics. Here's the problem. We're dealing with Cardassian virtue ethics. We're not just dealing with Dr. Mora and his ethical considerations for this interesting goo that we have. The Cardassians, and we learned this in the Deep Space Nine episode, Necessary Evil. We know that Dr. Mora was under a tremendous amount of pressure for results and answers from the Cardassians. And we know that, and we know this from Voyager, we know this from certainly the Next Generation, that Cardassians don't always have the same respect for life that most other life forms in the galaxy do. They, matter of fact, they were well known throughout the galaxy for performing what you and I would probably call Nazi-like experiments on sentient life forms. We're dealing with Cardassians here, and you know, Dr. Mora, I think, although I think at his core, Dr. Mora is a good man, you know, he's dealing with the pressure of, you know, this occupying force that are really wanting answers and results from his experiments. So much so that Odo says that Dr. Mora, even after he found out that he was sentient, taught him to do parlor tricks, the Cardassian neck trick, you know, to kind of impress the, you know, the Cardassian council. You know, give them a laugh and, you know, just play your part, do your thing, and you and I might both get out of this with our skin intact.
There's something deeply uncomfortable about this line of reasoning, though. The analogy with Nazi Germany, I think, is a troubling one because, I mean, think back to the Nuremberg trials. You know, how many times did they hear things like, I was just following orders, right? You know, I had a request from on high from my superior who got it from the Führer, right? And so I did these terrible things. And it's maybe not to the same degree with Dr. Mora because he's not doing, you know, deeply terrible things to Odo. He's not murdering him. He's not, you know, right. It's not a Holocaust scale here that we're talking about. But this idea that you can inflict pain and suffering on someone because you're getting pressure from your superiors and they're getting pressure from their superiors in an empire like the Cardassian Empire, it very much can be a troubling analogy with Nazi Germany. And I don't get the sense from the way that James Sloyan played Dr. Mora that this connection runs really deep. Generally, he plays Dr. Mora fairly sympathetically, right? Mm-hmm. You get the sense that he has some compassion for Odo. He has some sort of bond with him that Odo definitely doesn't reciprocate because he feels like he was abused in some way in the form of in the course of this research and in helping Odo become what he is. He's very much resentful, but you get the sense that Dr. Mora is connected to Odo in some way and has compassion. I don't get the sense that he has dehumanized Odo, that he has, you know, is willing to inflict unnecessary pain and suffering. I get the sense that deep down, at least, his motivations were largely benevolent, whether it's from a sense of trying to please your superiors or whether it's from the sense of trying to benefit Odo. I get that sense. So I don't think the connection with Nazi Germany runs very deep, that in this case, the overriding factor at the end of the day is probably the fact that Dr. Mora was trying to help Odo become the best version of himself. And yes, he was getting pressure and he had to perform and he was on the payroll like everyone else, right? But, you know, that wasn't the only motivation, and his motivation deeper than that was largely benevolent. I get that sense from the way Dr. Mora is played in the episode.
I tend to agree with you, but I don't think we should dismiss the Cardassian factor. I think it's something that we have to consider. Zachary, I'm thinking of the Voyager episode, Nothing Human, from the fifth season, in which B'Elanna is attacked by a insectoid-type life form that taps into her central nervous system, and she's fighting for her life. And so the doctor decides to consult the holodeck, and the holodeck gives him access to a brilliant exobiologist by the name of Krell Moset. However, we discover that Krell Moset's tactics were not just a little questionable among the Bajorans. We mentioned previously about the Nazis. His tactics were very reminiscent of the same types of tactics, not human experimentation, but rather Bajoran experimentation. He had a very questionable sense of ethics. And so, you know, at the end of the episode, the doctor, in order to save B'Elanna, allows Krell Moset, at least the holodeck's version of him, to participate in the procedure to save her life. But at the end of the day, he decides to delete the program because his own ethics prohibit him from really consulting with a doctor with that kind of reputation going forward. So I do think it's a consideration here. Although, again, you and I think both agree that Dr. Mora is no Krell Moset.
Well, I think it's possible, Mike, to give a charitable reading of Krell Moset. And this is where I want to push back a little bit, because Krell Moset takes what I consider to be a fairly utilitarian approach to his medical work, right? He's willing to, he basically thinks that some ends justify certain types of means, right? So saving B'Elanna's life, if you have to inflict pain and suffering on the being that's attacked her to save a crew member's life, that's a trade-off he's willing to make. So he has certain ends in mind. He thinks those ends are worth it, that the consideration about pain and suffering of other types of life forms, other species, lower level life forms, the being in question inside that episode of Voyager, that he's basically made a value judgment that certain ends are more important than certain other ends or the means used to achieve those ends. And I guess the thing that makes it charitable to me is that he's making a similar kind of value judgment that we often make here in the real world. We often say, when we do research on lower level life forms, for example, we often say, look, the benefit to a certain class of beings, namely us humans, we humans, right, matters more than the pain and suffering that we inflict on lower level life forms. Mm-hmm. That the end result is overall better because of that research, and we're willing to make that sacrifice. So yeah, if we have to kill a lab rat for the sake of curing a plague, that's a trade-off that a lot of people are comfortable with from the very same standpoint that Krell Moset is taking. Certain ends are more important. Certain beings matter more than others. Certain degrees of benefit matter more than the pain and suffering you inflict. The downside of that is that you can use that to justify almost anything, because the intrinsic nature of the action itself, the specific type of research or the specific action that's causing the pain and suffering, it's not that right and wrong lies in the nature of the action itself. The right and wrong from that standpoint lies in the intended consequences and the benefit that you see from those actions. And so from that standpoint, you don't see those actions as wrong because you're deriving what you perceive as benefit from them. So Krell Moset isn't perceiving his actions as immoral because he's aiming at what he sees as good ends. Same thing with Dr. Mora and Odo, and same thing for us here in the real world when we do any kind of research on what we perceive as a lower life form.
Indeed. Indeed.
Well, so have I made the case for, you know, the Cardassian standpoint not being as bad as it seems at first glance?
Oh, yeah. I certainly agree with that. But as I said, I do think it's a consideration. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think Dr. Mora's better judgments win the day. Again, I'll say it again. He's no Krell Moset by any stretch of the imagination. And I think also Odo agrees you know, quite honestly, in that, you know, once he's able to take a humanoid life form, what's the first thing he does? He mimics Dr. Mora's hairstyle, and with the greatest form of flattery, you know, for him to mimic the hairstyle. If he could get the nose right, he probably would have had the same number of ridges in his nose and whatnot. And, you know, it's kind of fun, I think, from a casting standpoint, because when we first get to meet Dr. Mora face to face, we've heard a little bit about him, but we don't really get to meet him face to face until season 2, episode 12, in the episode The Alternate. That's the first time Dr. Mora arrives at Deep Space Nine, and he's there, and Odo's very uncomfortable. A lot of people are making kind of references, especially Quark, who's having a heyday with Dr. Mora's arrival on the station. You know, that he's somewhat a father figure to Odo, and I think, for that matter, Odo feels the same way, and some of the resentment that he has, Zachary, I think is very similar to the resentment oftentimes that sons have you know, towards their own fathers. And Odo, in many respects, I think, emulates, of course, in this case, you know, Dr. Mora as a character, I think, was made to emulate more of Odo rather than the other way around. But from a storytelling standpoint, I think we find that Odo very much emulates some of the mannerisms and, you know, even some of the attitudes of Dr. Mora, you know, kind of like father, like son. And so some of that resentment, I think, is not so much a resentment of Dr. Mora as a scientist, but rather Dr. Mora as a person, and Odo's perception of being, you know, a son dealing with his own feelings about himself rather than Dr. Mora.
This is actually a little complicated to unravel, because what I'm hearing in what you're describing is at least two different threads that are related but still a little separate. One thread is the role of clinical detachment versus being versus caring for the subject that you're working with, right? I mean, both the consequentialist perspective and the deontological perspective can suffer from being detached, right? If you are trying to achieve a certain end, and you're willing to inflict some harm to achieve a certain end, and you're not attached to any of the beings involved in any kind of emotional or caring sense, then it's really kind of a cold, calculating way of deciding what to do. And the Cardassians arguably are cold and calculating, and they take that hardline consequentialist perspective, and they don't care about the beings that they're affecting, or they turn a blind eye to the suffering that they're causing. They don't allow themselves to be affected by it, right? If you're a Kantian or a deontological ethical theorist, you run the risk of being so rule based that, again, that you don't get attached to the human, or the not just human, because it's Star Trek, but the emotional burden of applying rules to a particular situation and the consequences that ensue, and, you know, the relational aspect between the clinician and the person being studied or the person being worked on, right? And so what you're describing to me is the role of not unattachment or detachment, but being attached. You know, what is the relationship between Odo and Dr. Mora? As Dr. Mora matures from his role as a Cardassian employed researcher to someone who can be more of a father figure to Odo, there's a relation between Odo and Dr. Mora that is more of an emotional attachment than a clinical detachment. And so it to me, it kind of begs this question of the third category of ethics, virtue ethics. What is the character with which you perform your role as a researcher or as a clinician? Is it important to be detached, or is it okay to care about your subjects in certain ways? What are the virtues and character traits and responsibilities, the relational responsibilities that you have as a researcher to your subject? Should the goal be clinical detachment, or does that leave out an important part of an important character trait of serving that role in an ethical standpoint? So in that sense, it's not just a question of which actions are right and wrong, but it's a question of what are the virtuous character traits of a researcher? Do we expect clinical detachment? Is that a virtue, or is it more of a virtue to care and be aware of the suffering that you're causing, even if it's necessary suffering to achieve a certain end? The Cardassians turn such a blind eye. I think humans look at Cardassians and say, look, we're more affected by that. We don't like to see the suffering of beings, even if we have to cause suffering sometimes, or at least least aware of it and we're affected by it and we at least feel guilty about it and try to find a better solution if we can. And Cardassians don't always seem to do that. So in my mind, I think, you know, humans are the kind of this perfect middle ground in Star Trek where, you know, Cardassians can take this hard-nosed consequentialist perspective, but, you know, a human researcher working on Odo may or may not be able to turn such a blind eye to the suffering that he's causing in the name of progress or in the name of helping Odo reach his potential or in the name of, you know, pleasing your Cardassian superiors. I just don't think it's obvious because in order to reach justified, you know, objective, scientifically neutral conclusions, you do need a level of detachment. You can't be so affected by your subject that you let your judgment be affected in negative ways and you're not reaching good conclusions anymore. On the other hand, you can't be so detached that you turn yourself into Krell Maset, being willing to cause pain and suffering all in the name of what you perceive as justifiable, good, positive ends.
I think you make an important distinction there when we're talking about virtue ethics. And I think Dr. Mora, I think there's an evolution that takes place. And I think we're kind of informed of this throughout Deep Space Nine. But in particular, I think the episodes in which we actually get to see Odo and Dr. Mora interact. And those two episodes, I've mentioned the alternate already from season 2, episode 12. And also in the fifth season, also episode 12, the episode The Begotten. And so I think those episodes really inform us that Dr. Mora's attitude towards Odo evolved as he made the distinction between Odo being a gelatinous non-life form to becoming a shape-shifting non-sentient life form to eventually, you know, realizing that, oh, this is a sentient life form. And then, of course, you know, we're seeing Odo here in Deep Space Nine as a fully autonomous being. And so Dr. Mora has evolved, I think, from a detached scientist to someone who very much cares for Odo. And I don't think you can watch that last scene in the alternate in which Odo has, you know, fully morphed into this beast because he's been affected by this gas that he inhaled in the Gamma Quadrant. And he's taking his frustration and anger. He's morphed into a beast and he's hunting Dr. Mora. And so in that last scene, they use Dr. Mora as bait, and they're able to trap Odo in a force field. And Sisko gives the very difficult order, and it's difficult for everybody. You know, hey, if worse comes to worse, we're going to have to kill him. And so they've got him in this force field, and he's struggling, he's suffering, and Dr. Mora recognizes that suffering. He's, you know, Odo in full beast mode, and Dr. Mora is heartbroken, Zachary. He's weeping, you know, he's biting his fist. He just can't stand to see Odo suffer. And he says, you know, through his tears, you know, oh, Odo, what have I've done it again. I've put you in chains. I've caged you, Odo. And he's just brokenhearted seeing Odo like this. And I don't think that comes from a detached scientist, Zachary. I don't even think it comes from somebody who's fond of Odo. I think there's a real love and care. In fact, during that episode, there are a couple of really interesting exchanges. Dr. Mora as a father figure. So Dr. Mora notices that the people in Deep Space Nine are calling him Constable. And Odo responds by saying, "It's a nickname I barely tolerate." And Dr. Mora recognizes the real issue, and he says to him, "It's an expression of affection that you find difficult to accept." And so there we see Dr. Mora as a father figure. He's still trying to shape Odo's attitudes and help him discover who he is, who, you know, himself. I see Dr. Mora as a protector when he realizes that, you know, this crime, that this these attacks that Odo's investigating have actually been perpetrated by Odo. Dr. Mora really goes into a sense of trying to protect him, and he's concerned about what the humans are going to do to him. And you know, Odo's just like, "Do," and he says, "You know what they're going to do? They're going to put you in a prison or quarantine you, or they're going to put you on a deserted asteroid in the Delta Quadrant, Odo. They'll put you in a zoo." And Odo says, "I don't believe that. You know, you don't know them." And Dr. Mora says, "What other humanoid have you been able to trust except me?" And of course, you know, Odo, like any son, I think would do in a situation like that, you know, what makes you think I trust you? You know, it kind of draws that line, puts up a wall. So I really see the relationship between them very much as everybody else does. It's one of a father and son. And I don't think if Dr. Morrow was a detached scientist, just doing his duty, occasionally crossing maybe some barriers, some ethical barriers in research science, I don't think that dynamic would be there at all, but it is.
What you're describing to me seems to be a type of parallel development that Odo and Dr. Mora go through together. As Odo morphs from what Dr. Mora perceives as a gelatinous non-life form to something more resembling a non-sentient life form that might be able to, you know, experience suffering, to a sentient life form, to the fully developed sentient life form that we know as Odo, that Dr. Mora goes from a degree of clinical detachment to, like as you described, the role of a loving father figure, you know. And I guess the question is, you know, I think undoubtedly we see that as progress. I think that the clinical detachment is probably, in the case of Dr. Mora, more of a harm, and the more fully developed Dr. Mora, who is more grounded in virtue, is the caring, loving father figure, mm-hmm. Dr. Mora. The question is, you know, in practical terms, here in the real world, can a researcher, whether it's a veterinary researcher or, you know, someone who does experimental treatments on humans, can you maintain your scientific objectivity and achieve certain ends that you're trying to achieve, solving, you know, curing diseases, solving problems, helping your patient, even if you have to cause pain and suffering to do it? Can you keep that level of detachment while simultaneously cultivating a sense of care and relationship and concern for the well-being of your patient, some hybrid of clinical detachment and loving father figure wrapped into one? Or are those contradictory? I guess I have a host of questions about that I don't have the answer to, of course, that's why I'm asking the question. One question is one approach more virtuous than the other? You know, is it better for a scientist to be detached, or do we want our scientists to be more like the loving father figure, Dr. Mora, after that development process? Another question is it possible to combine the two in some sort of consistent sense where you can still achieve certain goals and not be so detached that you end up turning into Krell and Set? You know, is that a consistent approach? Can you combine the best of both into the same role as a researcher, as a clinician, or as an experimental scientist who works on other biological beings? Or is there a fundamental tension there that is unable to be resolved?
I think those are all very fascinating questions, Zachary, and they're not easy to answer. I can speak to dealing with patients. I'm not a clinician, but, you know, for 9 years, I managed healthcare facilities. And I didn't really go into it with the expectation that I would form bonds and build relationships with my patients. You try to maintain a certain level of clinical detachment because, in my case, I'm dealing with patients, most of which who are suffering from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. It's the same disease that took Leonard Nimoy from us. And when a patient receives that diagnosis, it is a death sentence. It is. It's the number three killer in the world, and it's on the rise, as opposed to cancer and heart disease, which are on the decline. COPD is actually on the rise. And
you threw me for a loop. I thought C stood for changeling obstructive pulmonary disease.
Well, since changelings don't have respiratory systems as we know them, it is a death sentence for all intents and purposes because there is no cure for it. COPD is a progressive disease. It will continue to progress. You can treat it. You can slow down the progression, but you can't. There's no cure for it as it stands right now. And so when a patient were to walk into my facility with a new diagnosis, perhaps a prescription in hand for, you know, medical device or you know, some certain therapy that we provided from their doctor, their pulmonologist, it was our obligation to provide said medical equipment and said therapies. and I managed clinicians who were hands-on with the patients. But, you know, patients, they come in, they come out, and you deal with them from, you know, from a clinical standpoint, you deal with them in assisting them with their benefits, their billing, and so forth and so on. And in the course of dealing with these patients, there were many times, Zachary, in which I became very attached to them. And so I can relate to Dr. Moore a little bit, because I think very much from the beginning, you know, the sense is, you know, not so much attached. It's a thing that he has to discover, you know, what it is and what it's capable of. And, you know, once Odo develops, once he discovers, not so much Odo developing sentience, but once he discovers sentience, you know, you build that form. And, you know, did he lose that clinical detachment? I think to some degree, probably he did, but I, you know, to some degree, I don't think so. And we find out in the episode, The Begotten, from season 5, when Odo comes to be in possession of what we discover is an infant changeling, Zachary, and Odo is now solid, and he's got this infant changeling, and suddenly he's discovering something. And it's something I think that every son discovers about his father, and that is that it's difficult to make these decisions and to do your level best to make sure that your offspring really live up to their full potential and develop as they should and become everything that they're capable of becoming. And Dr. Mora and Odo, when Dr. Mora comes to Deep Space Nine, I think that this was the catalyst for the reconciliation of their differences, because Odo discovered that Dr. Mora wasn't, you know, a cruel taskmaster, but he was a loving father that occasionally, you know, didn't spare the rod.
Well, even emergency medical holograms allow themselves to get a little attached. Over on Voyager, everyone in the crew gets a Prixen card from the doctor. Seriously, Mike, though, what I think we're discovering is that there are two extremes, and reality is always somewhere in the middle. One extreme being extreme clinical detachment, the other extreme being so attached that you become such a delicate flower that you don't have scientific objectivity anymore. And in reality, you know, anyone who serves the role of a doctor, a clinician, or a researcher probably is pulled mm-hmm. in two directions, right? They are bound to keep some level of objectivity or to meet certain goals, whether it's in a utilitarian sense or whether it's in a practical, pragmatic sense. What problem are you trying to solve? And, you know, if they're even remotely compassionate, they will get some form of emotional attachment to the beings that they are working with or caring for or experimenting on. You know, I think it's unfortunate when you get pulled in too much of an extreme either way. If you get pulled in to the extreme of detachment, you just run the risk of turning yourself into Krell Maset. You're going to be a potential monster, right? You're not going to be aware of the suffering that you're causing, potentially to disastrous ends, either for the being in question or for a larger population. On the other hand, I think if you're so attached that you're not being objective anymore, you can make bad decisions that actually aren't in the patient's best interest. You can reach conclusions that are not justified based on what's happening with your subject. So the reality is probably somewhere in the middle. And I sort of see it as an irreconcilable tension, that the more objective you are, the more likely you are to not pay attention to the suffering that you're causing. The more you form attachments, the more your scientific objectivity is in question. As I see it, though, I think it's still probably safer to err on the side of attachment. The person who is extremely detached is in danger of committing very serious moral atrocities and causing a great deal of suffering. The person who is more attached may have trouble being detached and performing their research, may have trouble making judgments or conclusions that are in the best interest of the patient, but they are less in danger of causing great atrocities, I think. So if I had to pick a side to err on, I think it's probably better to err a little bit more on the side of compassion, a little bit less on the side of radical detachment.
Yeah, because just as Dr. Mora is no Krell Maset, he's no Dr. Salar either. I think it's going to be difficult for him to maintain.
He's no Phlox. He doesn't have optimism.
Well, think about this for a second. You know, think about, and Phlox is a good example. I think Phlox did a pretty good job for a majority of the series Enterprise maintaining a clinical objectivity. But, you know, even after 4 years of being on Enterprise, he built relationships and he became quite fond. And those familial relationships began to affect, first of all, I think, his perspective and then maybe to a lesser degree, even his judgment. There were times I thought, especially during the Zindi crisis in season three, where he probably could have pushed back a little bit more against Jonathan Archer. We see him certainly early on push back quite a bit, questioning Archer's motives and his tactics. And, you know, once we get to episode three, Archer says, you know, there's going to be casualties and you know, there's no pushback. He's just like, okay, we'll be ready. I'll have sick bay ready.
I was trying to think of doctors in Star Trek that err a little more on the side of compassion, a little more on the side of attachment. And the two doctors that came immediately to mind, you can correct me if I'm off base on either one of these, are Dr. McCoy and Dr. Pulaski. Both of them are willing to say to other people around them, in the case of Dr. McCoy, he'll say this to Spock. In the case of Dr. Pulaski, she will say this to Data, or she'll say it to Picard. They'll basically say, I'm sorry, that's damn cold. Mm-hmm. that approach is cold-hearted, it's not human, and that's not who we are. And am I wrong in making that conclusion? I think drawing those connections, I think those are the two doctors that out of all of the doctors that I see in Star Trek are more likely to get attached and not maintain their objectivity.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. And, you know, although we only get to actually see her in one episode, I'm sure that to some degree, Dr. Salar is probably very, very much the opposite. I mean, she's announcing to Dr.
She's a softie at heart. You know, she is.
Well, her response to Data and Captain Picard, you know, he's dead. And it was just a matter of fact. There was no, you know, there was no feeling. But she's a Vulcan for crying out loud. So, although we only see her in one episode, we know that there is a certain level of detachment, and her, you know, her attachment is only on a clinical level. There's no familial attachments to people because, after all, she's Vulcan. But
I love the idea of Dr. Salar, you know, after that event, you see her back in her quarters and she's like shedding a tear into her Romulan ale or something.
Zachary, I think another clinician, another researcher to kind of throw into this mix would be Dr. Bruce Maddox from Commander Maddox from Star Trek: The Next Generation in Measure of a Man. We are introduced to him as a researcher who frankly wants to dismantle Data. And you know, by the end of the episode, he's changed his tune a little bit. He's lost the case, and you know, Riker and Picard are able to establish that, you know, Data to some degree deserves the same rights as, you know, any Federation citizen. And Dr. Maddox recognizes at the end of that episode, we were joking in the turbo lift, you know, he's got a tear in his eye. He's remarkable. But even still, I think there is a certain detachment there. And I think he's probably a little bit over on the other side of that spectrum, as opposed to someone who's very attached and, you know, very emotionally driven.
Commander Maddox seems to have a similar development process that Dr. Mora had. Dr. Mora went from radically detached to having something of a fatherly relationship with Odo. Commander Maddox, it's not quite the same thing, but he moves from radical detachment. He's about ready to tear Data's limbs apart and dismantle him to thinking that he's remarkable. And we find out later in Data's day that they're exchanging letters. And it's maybe not quite as fatherly as Dr. Mora's relationship with Odo, but it's at least at the level of colleagues now, where they're exchanging letters and treating each other as equals now. At least that's the implication I get from the fact that Data and Commander Maddox are corresponding after the events in Measure of a Man. And I think you're right. Commander Maddox is not, he errs a little bit more on the side of clinical detachment. We don't get to see the end result. We don't get to see the fully developed Commander Maddox. But in my head canon, I think of Commander Maddox as being still a little more detached and not quite as emotionally invested in Data as Dr. Moore ends up being in Odo's well-being.
I agree. So, Zachary, we've been talking for just about an hour here. We've covered a few perspectives, you know, consequentialist ethics. We've talked a little bit about deontological ethics. And I should mention that a much more in-depth, detailed discussion of consequentialism and deontological ethics can actually be found in our back catalog, episode 6, entitled Whacking Vrenak. I would encourage our listeners to go back and listen to that discussion. It was, a much more in-depth, involved conversation about consequentialism versus deontological ethics. We've also talked a little bit about virtue ethics, which we've discussed numerous times here on the podcast. So again, for our listeners, go back and check out some of our conversations on virtue ethics in our back catalog. Just by way of starting to wrap things up, do you have any final thoughts about Dr. Mora and his relationship with Odo?
I'm not sure I have a lot to add above and beyond what we've already said about consequentialist ethics and deontological ethics and virtue ethics, except to say that what's particularly interesting about the relationship between Dr. Mora and Odo is the fact that they both go through a development process, so much so that we really see the full spectrum of different possible ethical theories and different possible approaches to the relationship between researcher and researchee, or clinician and patient, or higher life form and potentially lower life form. We get to see Dr. Mora taking this cold clinician standpoint, and we get to see him forming a relationship with Odo later. We get to see a question of rules, what you do and don't do, and what's justifiable and what's not justifiable, and we get to see the emotional fallout of those decisions from Odo's resentment to Dr. Mora. So it's an incredibly rich tapestry of possible ways of interpreting the situation, different approaches to scientific and medical ethics, and it's all wrapped in a neat little package in the relationship between these two characters.
I think that probably more than, you know, a clinician and a subject type of relationship, I think Dr. Mora, Pohl, and Odo, their relationship is more marked of that of a father and a son. And, you know, we can talk about some of the clinical methods, but at the end of the day, once Dr. Mora discovered Odo's sentience and Odo began to make that leap from, you know, a sentient life form to really a fully autonomous being, I think that relationship between the two of them really evolved into something, you know, that really transcends that of a clinician and a subject. And once we get to the begotten, you know, that relationship is very much that of a father and son. And Odo is trying to be a better father. And I think it's something that anyone out there who is listening to the podcast, who is a parent, I think can really get that. Your goal is to try to do a better job. You want to be a better parent. You hopefully want to pass on to your kids, your values and provide for them at least to some degree better than perhaps what you were. And, you know, there are those of us out there who didn't have, you know, the best parenting in the world. And, you know, you definitely want to raise the bar. And I think that was Odo's attitude very much. And I think that he came to really see things through Dr. Mora's eyes and through his perspective. In fact, at the end of that episode, The Begotten, he admits that he now had a better idea of, you know, what Dr. Mora was going through, you know, when he left the Institute, and, you know, the pain that, you know, his leaving the Institute, how that impacted Dr. Mora. So, you know, there's very much a tapping in of these familial emotions.
Well, if you thought that the relationship between medical researcher and researchee was complicated, try the relationship between fathers and sons. As Captain Picard would say, you know, fathers and sons, and Riker would say, understood. That's complicated.
I think there are some real similarities here in the storytelling in the alternate and the begotten that we see in the Icarus Factor and Unification, where we explore Riker's relationship with his dad and Spock's relationship with his father. And so the storytelling is very similar. And
yeah, some of the same issues come up, right? We get to see a cold, detached version of a father in Sarek. We get to see something of that in Riker's father. And you get to see kind of the emotional fallout. You get to see the development from cold and detached to having some sort of understanding relationship with the sons in those examples. So yeah, that's actually a really interesting connection, because some of the same issues come up. How detached are you in your relationship to your offspring? And what's the development process like to reach a middle ground between being so detached that you give people a push out the door to become the best versions of themselves and actually having a more caring relationship? It's a remarkably parallel storytelling device.
Well, this concept of tough love. I mean, you know, they're trying to get this, you know, this little puddle of goo to do something. And I love how Odo is sweet talking the infant changeling, and oh, come on now, come on, you know you want to do it. And this is a sphere. And
frankly, this is a great analogy, because we've been emphasizing the medical ethics aspect of the relationship between Odo and Dr. Mora, but equally important is the paternal relationship. And you basically said that fathers think of their sons as little puddles of goo that need to do something. Mm-hmm. Right? And that, to some extent, that's true. When you have an offspring that's not fully developed, that offspring has to develop, and you have to make it be the best version of itself. And sometimes that means you have to inflict punishment. Sometimes that means you have to provide advice or mentoring or teach tough lessons and give tough love, as you said. And that's part of having a paternal relationship. And some of those things are, some of those are not healthy, but some of those things are healthy, and they're part of the natural development process. So yeah, offspring as puddles of goo that have great potential.
Yeah. And Odo has to turn to Dr. Mora. You know, he's frustrated because, you know, he thought that his tactics and his ways of doing things were going to produce better results, and they weren't, quite frankly. And so he has to turn, you know, here's the son turning to the father and saying, you know, Dad, I need some parenting advice here. And Dr. Mora kind of rolls up his sleeves. He gets in there. Okay, we're gonna put a little electrical charge here on the table. And oh, I don't want to do that. Well, spare the rod, spoil the child. You know. And they turn that thing up, and then finally they get some results. And suddenly Odo realizes, oh, hey, sometimes love's tough.
See, now where I'm picturing kind of a rewrite of the Icarus Factor in the Next Generation, where Kyle Riker busts out the electrodes and shocks Commander Riker. You're gonna be captain someday, darn it. Or some sort of like electrified jujitsu.
I'm picturing, instead of in an ambujitsu, the armor that they wear, all that padded armor, is actually electric conducting armor. And those staffs that they use are electrodes. And so then Dr. Pulaski's over there flipping the switch. She's turning up the juice. You got to give him a little bit more, Kyle. Right? You got to give him a little bit more.
Well, Pulaski does have kind of a stepmotherly relationship with Riker, given that, as you recall, never forget, Pulaski banged Riker's dad.
How can I forget that? Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Dr. Mora and the ethics of scientific research. But as always, this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Don't watch any of the extras on the first disc, because they're all duplicated over the second disc. So then that way you can just watch them in order and not have to worry about, oh, well, let me skip this one because I watched it on the first disc and do all that.
Wait, to clarify, they have all the special features in column A on one disc, and then all the special features of column A plus column B on a second disc?
That is correct.
That makes no sense to me at all.
I know, I was very confused when I sat down to watch it.
Melodic Treks.
matter? I barely know her. Oh, it's painful. I don't know. You snowing me? You snowing me?
Painful is just saying Remus and blah, blah. I felt myself falling asleep. I felt like it was my parents were telling me a good night story where you were giving me that track listings there that... like.
Does it still McFly?
That's one of my favorite ones.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Within about 15 seconds, you texted me back, Dr. Giggles, we have to do Dr. Giggles. And my question for you is,
yes,
why did we absolutely have to do Dr. Giggles?
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions, and that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's Patreon, patreon.com/trekfm. You'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar in our MetaTreks show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
And on Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm. And find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click Discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not practicing the Cardassian neck trick, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, you can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not in the kitchen making shape-shifting Jell-O salads, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, as always, I'm most active on Facebook. Certainly you can find me there and around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram occasionally at cmichael1701. Well, we'd like to take a moment, Zachary, to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to give our thanks to C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM. Couldn't do it without you, Chris. Our executive producers, Sharlin Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager. I'd also like to give a special shout-out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. We appreciate your contribution to MetaTreks and to the network. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. And also Kay Shaw. Again, Kay, we really appreciate your contribution to Metatrex and to the network as a whole. You can connect with Kay on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is at ChocoWeeble. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.